This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's episode, we travel to the New York suburb of Ossining, where an Earth Day celebration was convened at the estate of Beth and the late Corliss Lamont by the International Service Organization Volunteers for Peace. The gathering on a sunny but windy day was addressed by keynote speaker Tom Weissmuller of the colder side, Veterans for Peace founder Peter Coldwell, our public affairs director Kathy Davis, and your host. Entertainment was provided by the Rivertown Kids, accompanied by Dan Einbinder, and the event was hosted by Peace volunteer and WBAI producer Andrew Bell. This is 5 o'clock Shadow, and I'm Robert Knight in New York. We begin with an interactive outdoor presentation on weather and climate by Peter Coldwell.
Incoming sunlight passes right through the CO2 in the atmosphere because CO2 happens to like the longer wavelengths to trap heat. So it comes in, if it bounces off, it goes right back and the planet doesn't get that warm. We've seen the effect of that for the last 15 years. The northern hemisphere temperatures since 2007 have basically flatlined. Now, I'm talking about surface temperatures, not the oceans. The oceans are still getting warmer. And the oceans, by the way, are a greater heat trap than the atmosphere. So like a 1,000-to-1 difference between the air's ability to retain heat and water's ability to retain heat. Water is much more dense and does retain the heat. But our surface temperatures are basically flat. CO2, by the way, is still going up. It is rising at the same rate it has for the last 50 or 60 years that we've been keeping very, very detailed records. But temperatures haven't. Over land, they flatlined. Now, you say to yourself, gee, we had a real warm winter this past year. Didn't happen here. Why was last winter warmer here than usual? By the way, if it makes you feel better, in Asia and Europe, it was terribly cold, and it offset it. But we had a phenomenon called La Niña. La Niña is a cooling of the equatorial Pacific. Now, you have to imagine the world off of South America, and the equatorial Pacific stretches all the way over to Australia. Why was the equatorial Pacific cool for a couple of years? The answer is clouds had formed over the ocean. If you have clouds forming over the ocean, sunlight hitting the clouds also reflects off the cloud tops the same way it does off of snow. Not only that, the clouds that form over the equatorial Pacific tend to be thunderstorm-like clouds, cumulonimbus. What they do is they stir up the ocean. Now, the trade winds also stir up the ocean. They create evaporation. You know when you sit in a dentist chair and a dentist blows air over your cavity? All of a sudden, your tooth feels cool. Why? Because what's happening is that the water that's on your tooth evaporates into air, becomes water vapor, and steals heat from your tooth. So your tooth feels really cold. When wind goes over the equatorial Pacific and evaporates water vapor from the ocean, it also steals heat from the water. And the equatorial Pacific ends up being cold. Not only that, rain falls on it from these thunderstorms, and that cools the ocean. So if you have the equatorial Pacific being relatively cold, relative to its normal temperature anyway, and you have the polar area, which is always cold, the contrast between the two is lessened. If you lessen the contrast, you have less airflow between the equator and the pole, and the jet stream that carries the storms across the northern hemisphere flattens out and goes laterally across the United States. So storms go straight across the country. They don't pick up any moisture, and it's relatively dry. When the equatorial Pacific is warm and hot, meaning no clouds, absorption of sunlight by the water, and water absorbs a lot of sunlight, by the way, the equator gets warm, high temperature contrast, and the jet stream then begins to undulate. It picks up cold air from the north, brings it down. That warm equatorial air goes up, and we see that effect in literally waves in the jet stream. They pick up storms and moisture. We have lots of climate variability, and that happened two winters ago when we had all the snow. Why do you have all the snow? You have the jet stream coming around the Texas coast, picking up moisture from the Gulf. The moisture falls into the cold air coming down from the pole, and we get lots and lots of snow. It didn't happen last winter. It was fairly easy to see that it wasn't going to happen. And the neat thing is, WBAI had me on there in December. That broadcast is archived. And before the winter happened, I was able to tell people, because of La Nina, we're just not going to have a lot of snow this winter. And that happened here in the United States. Didn't happen in the lake effect snow, ocean effect snow I talked about, over the Arctic Ocean, inundated Asia and Europe with cold air, moisture coming from the Mediterranean Sea, then fell into colder air. We had lots and lots of reflectivity, and the Northern Hemisphere actually was cooler for the last few months that we've just gone through than normal. This is probably going to be one of the coldest, from a global standpoint, the coldest years in the last 15 or 20 years. So the temperature's not rising that much anymore over land, and people are saying, okay, global warming, no problem, it's over, and it's not over. The oceans are still getting warmer. We still need to do things about managing our climate, managing our resources. Don't be misled by the fact that we've had a relatively innocuous winter here. The next couple of years are probably going to be a little bit different because the opposite of La Nina is going to happen. It's called El Nino. Clouds are going to disappear. A really warm equator, and which means lots of temperature variation here. So next winter, I think we're going to see a little bit more snow, and the following winter, maybe even worse. Since I can't predict the future entirely, hang around, go to WBAI this December. Hopefully Ken Gale will have me on his ecologic program again, and I'll be able to give you a decent and hopefully for the fifth year in a row, really accurate forecast of what your winter is going to be like. Okay, the La Nina has kind of broken up already. It's beginning to, you actually can see signs of El Nino forming, which means my prediction for this summer is that we're going to have more variability than we had last summer. Now, if you recall, last summer we had a fairly uniform, relatively cool summer, except for one week in August or so when you had this big blob of Texas air come up north. But we had very little in Maine. I never even put my air conditioner in. Didn't need to. This year is going to be a little bit different. I think we're going to get more undulations in the jet stream. You actually saw one beginning of March. We had a huge influx of air from the south, which warmed temperatures all the way up to Maine. It got in the 80s, which is very, very unusual for early March. We're going to see more of that. We're going to have a beautiful day like you see today, and in a few days it's going to get cool. And that's what I call about temperature variation. So expect a few heat waves. Expect a few delightful cool snaps. I don't think we're going to be freezing this summer. That won't happen around here. So things have changed for a more normal variation in our climate. And we'll keep our eyes peeled to the weather shows. Yes, sir.
So the greater undulation of the jet stream is a direct consequence of the warming of the oceans.
It's actually the temperature contrast between the equatorial waters and the polar waters. So if you have a high contrast, air likes to flow between the two of them. If you have no contrast, there's no reason for the air to move from one place to the other. Now, by the way, one of the consequences of having that lateral jet stream flow that we had here is that the cold air is kept in place over the pole. So Alaska had record snows. Anchorage has never had that much snow as it had this winter. 133 inches, and it's still snowing up there, by the way. Okay? That's going to change. You're going to get some of that colder air moving into the continental United States. Yes, sir? So that the people who are listening to the mic can hear it, you said there's going to be a greater contrast in temperatures so that there will be, in fact, greater undulation in the jet stream and more air coming down from the pole and more air moving up from the equatorial zones. If anything, the ice is going to recover this year. Why? Because it was so cold this past winter. The refreezing of the polar seas is actually happening right now. We almost matched the 2007 record of open Arctic in 2011, in September of 2011. It set up that lake effect, ocean effect snow, which made Europe and Asia be very cold. But because it stayed so cold up there and that air didn't change, it was on average 10 degrees colder over the pole. Usually it's 68 below zero. It was 78 to 88 below zero most of the winter. So the refreezing of the polar sea is happening right now. The Bering Sea has refrozen about 300 miles further south than it usually refreezes. We are not going to see a 40% open Arctic in September this year. We're probably going to gain about maybe 200,000 square kilometers. Wait 2 years, and it's going to melt again. Yes, sir, way in the back. Okay, the question was, does the current solar max have any significance? I would always say yes, because it's the sun that drives climate on this planet. And we've had a 3 or 4 year longer minimum than usual, and now sunspot activity is picking up. More solar radiation is hitting the Earth. We're going to be treated to a few more auroras than usual. And yes, there is more solar input coming in. However, the increase of El Nino is very likely related to that increase in solar activity, which means the equatorial Pacific is going to be warming, higher temperature contrast, and more variability in our weather. Not necessarily more heat, but certainly more variability. Good question. Yes, sir. The question was, with my confidence that global warming is still occurring, how do you deal with the naysayers? Well, there's different solutions that are being proposed. You've got to be careful that the right solution is being talked about. The oceans are still getting warmer, but if you're on land and you're freezing, I mean, if I go to Anchorage, Alaska, and I try to tell someone there's global warming going on, they're going to look at me like I'm crazy. You need to understand that this is a global issue, and you're talking about climate on a world scale, and an individual event in any given location is not going to color the difference in the world. But the link between carbon dioxide and climate seems to have broken to the point where albedo, I think, has overtaken its impact. Albedo being that reflectivity. If you cover all of Asia and Europe with reflecting energy of snow, the CO2 does not have the impact it used to have. In fact, over snow-covered territory, CO2 actually has an effective parts per million, which is even below the 350 that Mr. McKibben is saying we ought to be targeting. Why? Because the incoming sunlight that hits the snow pierces the CO2 on the way down and pierces it on the way up when 70% goes into space and leaves the Earth and leaves the Earth's heat budget. So the focus on CO2 at this point is probably counterproductive because, and I think the greatest danger for the environmental movement is that people look at CO2 and the broken link between temperature and say, oh, the problem is over. We don't have to worry about resource management anymore. And carbon management and resource management are different than CO2 management, and you don't want one pulling the rug out from the other. So, you know, the thing is that what I like to do is try to educate as many people as I can over what's really happening in the world, so that you can make the proper decisions and not be misled by any given season's temperature contrast over the experience you have over a lifetime. Hopefully that answers the question. Yes, sir. Two questions. Can humankind do anything about current conditions? And what are the actions that people should take? Well, there's a couple of actions. First of all, make the distinction between resource conservation and carbon management and management of carcinogens and poisons entering our environment. My great fear is that because the CO2 link may be impaired, that people are going to say, well, EPA, you made a mistake. Well, maybe they should, because EPA was founded to focus on poisons, carcinogens, and horrible things coming into our rivers and into our air. And I think their focus on CO2 has diverted their attention from that. We still need to look at the terrible, unhealthy things that are coming into our environment and work with industry, work with people to try to ameliorate and eliminate those things. And I think we ought to focus it on a priority order of the things that are most dangerous and get rid of those first, and then second, and get rid of those second, that kind of thing. But I think we need to ask EPA to, for a while at least, remove their focus from CO2 and focus again on poisons. Clean up our rivers. We have a lot of rivers here that need a lot of help, not just the Bronx River, the Hudson River, the Nile River, the River Rhine in Europe. You can't find a fish in there anymore. The Chicago River. Well, you can point to every river in the world. We need help in our rivers. And EPA can help manage that. You can work with industries on the side of the rivers. You can work with flood control so that when you do have a flood, you don't overflow the pollution plants on the side, which take care of waste and things like that, and then dump them into the rivers. We do need help. We need help in our atmospheres. You don't want to live on the windward side of a coal plant. And maybe there are different ways to take care of our power management so that we don't pollute the earth in the process of generating power that everybody uses. There are a lot of things that we can do. Again, the environmental movement should not hook onto CO2 as a lifeline, because that lifeline may drop, and then you neglect the other things that we really ought to worry about. Yes, ma'am. Okay. The question is, what can we do in our own space, in our own living area, to help? I'm a huge fan of recycling. In fact, better than recycling is reusing. Don't just take that milk container that you had milk in and throw it in the recycle bin. Do what I just did over here, fill it with water and bring it out and use it to drink water. Reusing is way better than recycling. Aluminum, by the way, if you put aluminum waste in recycle, it is, when it comes back to the plants that make aluminum, it is like getting 99.9% pure ore. When you make aluminum, you use huge amounts of electricity to take bauxite, and which has like 4% aluminum in it, get rid of all the waste, and then you separate the aluminum. The aluminum that we recover here is a beautiful godsend to the plants. You use much, much less electricity, and you get to use clean, environmentally friendly aluminum as long as we keep on reusing it. So recycle personally, use less energy if you can, and that involves thermostat management. Do what you can to support the activities in your community that make it a better place to live. There's lots of things you can do as a person. The fact is, you may not, where you live, have a compost heap in your backyard. Now, Walt Whitman has one now in his backyard, but the fact is you can bring your compost to a community place and put it in there. Keep the bag out. And by the way, I noticed Mrs. Lamont has one right in her kitchen. So she has it there and is using it. Another question. Yes. Okay, there are two questions. First, does the total snow cover of in Asia mitigate some of the methane release from the permafrost that's melting there? And the second was about a solar storm. Solar storms have had the effect, by the way. I'm going to answer the questions backwards. What happens if there's a solar storm? Solar storms have impacted the power grid. And with huge influxes of solar radiation and particles from the sun, we've had a couple of blackouts. So we have learned from this, and I think the grid is a little more robust than it used to be. You will get delightful auroras at night, even down here at these latitudes, but you got to wait till it gets really dark. I don't think there's more damage. There is more radiation coming onto the earth, which is going to make things a little bit warmer. Now, back to your first question, the covering of the permafrost is a temporary help because it keeps the ground covered longer and frozen longer. I think that's going to improve things. Methane is about 20 to 30 times, I think 23 times more heat trapping than CO2. However, methane is less than 2 parts per million in the atmosphere, so CO2 has a greater impact, water vapor even more. But it's not the gases a cover on the Earth, which is going to be very significant in the near future. It's going to be the reflectivity of the snow, because sunlight that leaves the Earth and doesn't come back is out of the Earth's heat budget. We need to be able to deal with that, deal with the fact that it'll be land temperatures will tend to be cooler. El Nino will spark it up a little bit. Keep your eye on the meteorology. Listen to BAI. They have good programs, and you're getting good information on climate from BAI. So I'm pleased and privileged to occasionally be on the station, too. Yes, sir. The question was, does the increasing of hydrofracking and other extraction methodologies have any impact on the atmosphere? And the answer is yes, for in a couple of different ways. Number one, if you end up liberating more natural gas, you end up using it. People don't take the natural gas out of the earth and do nothing with it. When you use natural gas, yes, you are adding carbon dioxide and some other pollutants to the air, probably less than coal, by the way. The byproducts are some methane release, which also adds to the air. The total contribution to warming, I think, has been overestimated. I think that the trick is to use our natural resources wisely. If hydropower is available, I'd prefer that to be used versus coal or nuclear or some of the other options. I think you need to choose and pick and choose where, if you can, you get your power from. Use renewable as much as possible. You cannot rely on wind power permanently to get your electricity, because occasionally the wind decides to die down. We need to learn how to store energy better. I'd love to see our government fund energy storage research. Someone once told me that we could run New York City on the electricity that is gotten by lightning hitting the Empire State Building every year if we could only figure out how to store that electricity. We don't know how to do it. There's a device called a capacitor, which can absorb large amounts of electricity. The problem is it discharges them in the same zap, and you can't just put an electric motor on a capacitor, you'll fry it. We need to learn how to store the electricity and then bleed it off slowly. We don't know how to do that yet. Best storage we have is chemical storage. The Canadians sometimes, at night when no one's using electricity, pump water back up their dams so that they use the next day and they gain about 5% of electricity. But it's not the kind of storage that's going to solve our problems. We need more research in that area. So get legislators into office who promise to work on energy storage. It's very important. There's not enough of it going on today in the world. The other thing, by the way, and I really want to thank the Lamont family for having done what they did to help create the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, probably the greatest assemblage of Earth-oriented scientists anywhere in the world. It's right across the river. Columbia runs it, but it was the Lamont family that set aside the land so that that whole thing could be created. And the people I talk about when I give my climate lectures, which is Maurice Ewing and his theories, Ewing ran the Lamont-Doherty for almost 25 years. Brilliant scientist, wouldn't have been here without the Lamont family. So I'd like you to give her a nice hand of applause, because that family deserves it.
Much appreciated.
Utopia means a perfect world. Solartopia means a green power world, which in our case is a perfect world.
Sure. That's sweet.
Thank you.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, Solartopia, don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's great world? Well, we may.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? 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 Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world? We multiplied and we needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The fuel ran scarce and the price jumped higher. So we gave nuclear power a try, but don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world? But the nuclear plants were built in haste, with too many risks, no place for waste. And so from Seabrook to Shoreham Town, we had to shut those new plants down. But don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world? Now we're fighting wars over oil and gas. No matter who wins, it will not last. The earth is scarred and the planet is warming. Don't you think that all of it's a great big warning? Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. It falls down to earth like rain from heaven. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
One more time.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Thanks again to the Rivertown kids.
Thank you, everybody.
There is no place too remote for the heartwarming inspiration of children singing to come into our lives. Thank you very much. We have a presentation especially for you. We want you to hear about Volunteers for Peace and the international volunteer opportunities that await you in over 100 countries around the world. This program was designed by the person who is about to speak to you so that he can get you and perhaps you with your families abroad to meet people from Japan and Senegal and Australia and find out what they're singing about in their part of the globe. Without further ado, the founder of Volunteers for Peace, Mr. Peter Coldwell.
Thank you, Andrew. Well, I love that singing. It just is so wonderful to listen to. I started Volunteers for Peace back in the early 80s because basically my wife and I were scared beyond belief about nuclear war during the Reagan years. And so we made an all-out effort to build a bridge between young people in Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, and the West. So over a period of about a decade, it was remarkable how, through a really strong effort of citizen diplomacy, things turned around. I mean, the Iron Curtain fell way, way, way before I ever imagined that it would. But basically, our program is a very old program. It's almost 100 years old. It was formed after World War I. It arose out of Europe. And basically, the concept is you get, say, 10 or 12 people from six or more countries that don't know each other in advance, and they arrive in a community somewhere on the planet, and they live together like a family and share the day-to-day activities of food preparation, cleanup, recreation, etc. And they focus on a voluntary service project that is a benefit to the local community. So the work projects arise from the grassroots. They might be working with kids, might be doing an environmental project, recycling, agriculture, construction, renovation, you name it. So the seeds were sown way back then, and now it's a network where roughly about 100,000 volunteers are exchanged every year. And throughout Europe, these programs, you know, through youth departments of the various countries, are funded by the European Union. It's much less known here in the United States. So there's a long history there, and we're kind of part of the puzzle. And we offer, you know, through our network, about 3,000 programs in 80 or 90 countries, depending on the year, throughout the world. So if you're interested, you can go to our website, vfp.org, and all the information's there. You can call our office if you want to be counseled on regarding work camp placement. And we look forward to your participation. Thank you.
Miss Kathy Davis, who gave me my start in radio.
Yes, thank you. I just was asked to say a little something from the perspective of indigenous people. I consider myself to be indigenous in whole or part. But one of the things that's important to remember is that before this country and before most lands were colonized, people lived in harmony with the earth, if not with each other, at least with the earth. And I just think that each of us can take on that perspective, and where we can in our lives find harmony with each other and with the earth, and understand that this planet is a living being. That's the perspective. When we're walking on the earth, we're actually walking on a living being. Our bodies are made up of the same elements of this planet, and we're really united as one. Even though we're millions of individuals, we're like the fingers on the hand in terms of peopling the earth. And we have to be very conscious of that. And I believe that as we hold that consciousness, it will help things like this to build. And because the world and transitions and change happens because of energy, I just wanted to, you know, let Andrew know that this is not just a physical event, it's an energetic event. There are a lot of this energy that's coming from this that gets united on a superconscious level with what everyone else is doing this weekend. And so this is important for the activation of the land right here and for the planet. So I say thank you.
Let's say thank you to Mother Earth. Woo! All right. So, Rivertown kids, where are you guys going next? Going home? On a beautiful day like this, no parks, no... Oh, I've got to ask while I've got you here. I mean, by a difference of about 3 decades, we have seen some absolutely enormous changes in the way we live our lives. Has anyone ever been to Indonesia? You want to go to Indonesia? And if you were in Indonesia, what would you like to do with your time? You would like to eat? Okay, well, Volunteers for Peace provides food to its volunteers. When you register at vfp.org and you sign up for your project in Indonesia, and there are close to, I don't want to say it. There's more than 10, less than 30 projects in Indonesia because there are a lot of islands and all of that good stuff. You'll be living with someone, say, from Japan or South Africa, another person from the U.S., someone from France, and you'll all get to meet each other and talk about what you do, what you're Twittering about, what's on your Facebook account, and there will be someone there with an organization who will be able to guide you to great local restaurants, and you'll be able to cook with people who are from Indonesia. So are you going to go to vfp.org?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Who wants to go to Australia? Yeah. And what would you do if you were in Australia?
Study all the poisonous animals.
Does anyone like dolphins? Yeah. Well, you could go to Monkey Maya and swim with the dolphins. Have you ever heard of the Aborigines? Yes, well, they have their inner working camps that reach out to people and teach them about the indigenous culture there. So Volunteers for Peace is a great way to make your imaginations, your dreams become real, because we are an organization that facilitates dream making. It's not just travel physically, it's travel
psychically. It's travel spiritually. You become a part of the place that you inhabit. Just like we're among these trees and this sky and this beautiful ground, we are actually inhaling the aroma of what Mother Earth is producing. And when you go to another part of the world, it actually gets into your pores. It becomes a part of you and you become a part of it, which is why we say that international voluntary service is so very important. We are far less likely to volunteer to join an army that is going to drop bombs on a country that we have visited and met people there who are like us, peace-loving, who love to sing, who love to eat food from Indonesia, and who like to Twitter and all of these wonderful things that you bright young people are doing. So think about international voluntary service. Think about Volunteers for Peace, that's VFP.org, and help us facilitate your evolution as a conscious human being. We are very proud of you. Very proud that you exist, something we can brag on for those of us that don't have children. I can say that I know you at least, and that's a good thing. And now, presentation by the only Robert Knight.
Thank you, Andrew. What an MC, huh? He's one of the brightest new people at WBAI. And that's where I work too. I do a radio program called 5 O'Clock Shadow and another one called Earth Watch. And I saw this little globe here and I said, ew, it's covered in oil. You know, that's what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico right now. 2 years after the BP company, used to be called British Petroleum, had the worst oil release in American coastal history. Today, the damage and doom is still unknown. Today, as we speak, oysters are dead. Shrimp don't have their eyes. The amphibians are dying. The dolphins are coming out stillborn because the government lied. And BP lied when they said that the oil had disappeared and dissipated. It did no such thing. They were in such a panic with the Macondo deep water fire and blowout that killed nearly a dozen people, 11 is the exact number. They did something that had never been done in the environment before. They took an oil-cutting chemical called Corexit. Corexit is pretty much the same thing as is in your dishwashing fluid called Dawn. And it is something that the oil industry offshore has secretly used when the Coast Guard comes to inspect a facility. It cuts the oil, it breaks it down into little bitty bubbles, and it dissipates, and you don't have the oil slick that you usually see. Well, they released millions of gallons of this on the oil release of the Macondo well. And what it did was simply make the oil sink and like a sediment be pushed around the entire Gulf of Mexico, which is why the fish are dying, why the dolphins are ill. And yes, there is even a human malady. The ingestion of this over a period of time has an effect on the brain. And in New Orleans, there's a saying, when somebody kind of gets a little bit kind of, you know, dizzy or forgetful, they call it not an Alzheimer's moment, they call it, I just had a BP moment. Of course, the marshland has been devastated, an important thing that is at the threshold between the salt water and the inland freshwater. The farmers are suffering from hidden seepage of oil. And this process of dangerous offshore drilling is also going on in Alaska. And God help us, President Barack Obama, the Interior Department, the Energy Department, committed themselves to go gung-ho with offshore drilling. Check this out. Barack Obama and Secretary Salazar went to an Air Force military base where they used some synthetic fuel on one of the killer fighter bombers called the Hornet. And I swear to God, these fools said, we're so proud because we're using this fuel now, and we're going to call it the Green Hornet. I swear to God. The Gulf of Mexico is not the only body of water recklessly ruined by bad energy policy. Dare I say, the Pacific Ocean is now boiling hot with radiation from the millions of gallons of water that is rinsed through those four doomed nuclear power stations at Fukushima on the coast of Japan. The water table locally has been impacted, and they don't know what to do. They are now trying to put a diaper underneath these nuclear plants. Yes, yes, they're trying to dig under and put this huge sheet of plastic around it, hoping that the radioactive water from these plants that is necessary to keep them from heating up and reigniting the nuclear fission process. They want to use plastic and a concrete bathtub around these reactors, which, of course, they'll never be able to do. It's going to take decades to clean that up. But in the meantime, you have eaten your last tuna, if you know what's good for you, because the debris from the tsunami is now hitting the west coast of the United States, and the water currents are not far away. They move at differential rates depending on the depth. And the cesium and other byproducts of the released nuclear fuel tends to the bottom, where they are eaten by the crustaceans. They're eaten by the shrimp and the lobsters and the krill. And then the bigger fish eat them. And then it goes all the way up to the huge tuna. And nuclear and environmental experts I've spoken with say it takes about a year for this radioactive material, these particles, to move up the food chain to where they're at the tuna that we might like to eat. The same thing is happening to the red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico. And the Obama administration, at that March 31st, 2010 press conference, announced that they were going to ensure the safety of the environment and double down on offshore drilling. Then along came the Deepwater Horizon incident, and we were given a nonsensical six-month moratorium on offshore drilling, and now Obama and company are saying they want to resume. And the only reason they had a moratorium, aside from public relations, is because that single spill was so bad that all of the booms and emergency ships and equipment had been exhausted from dealing with that one oil leak. BP presently has in place a plan for drilling down and sideways on a gravel island off the coast of Alaska with the same kind of drilling errors that happened at Deepwater, the same kind of drilling and cement errors that happened in Azerbaijan off the Caspian Sea, where the same kind of accident happened. We might love Obama, but does Obama love the Earth? Because I say all of that to take a look at the real elephant or donkey in the room, and that is the United States military, the single greatest polluter and contributor to greenhouse gases and carbon emissions on this planet Earth. You have no idea how much fuel is spent carrying troops and tanks and planes and helicopters and food and other materials to the remote places in the world, such as over the Khyber Pass, which Pakistan is currently not allowing, to fight the war in Afghanistan, to fight the war in Iraq. The Iraq war alone consumed 500,000 tons of carbon, when you consider the fire of the explosions, the exhaust of the transportation systems. And it's not just the Pentagon. They have a substantial number of private contractors who are also burning up gas and adding to the environment. The Pentagon is the single worst polluter on the planet. And what has the United States government done? It has pretended to take part in the Kyoto Conference. It pretended to take part in the more recent environmental conference, but the United States government, as a requirement for even pretending to engage in these protocols, is that the Pentagon not be counted in the measurement of carbon taxes or of the measurement of pollution. And here we stand again with another recent boom of these materials from the war in Libya and the current war in Syria and the intended war in Iran. The problem that we have is that we vote for the government, but the government votes for the energy companies. That's why the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it is using the State Department, and you can see this in the WikiLeaks secret cables, how our diplomatic offices are being used to promote a new kind of nuclear plant called the AP1000. What's different about it? Well, they say it's safer because instead of having a motor to pump the cooling water into the reactor vessel, they simply put a great big tank of water up on the roof. Anybody remember the old-timey water closets? You pull the chain and it would come down? Well, what happens once it's emptied if the crisis continues and the power lines and the grid coming to the plant are no longer working after 36 or 48 or 72 hours? This is being pushed by the federal government. And this is a moment where on this Earth Day, there is a conjunction between the environment and the peace movement. Because the only way to substantially preserve the atmosphere is to stop burning so much fuel and explosives for war. Whether it's under the cover of the United Nations or NATO or unilateral American actions, there is something that is congealing between institutions like Volunteers for Peace, with the Earth Movement, the environmental movement, and the new energy of the Occupy movement. I propose that there be strategies to count the Pentagon, to make the federal government admit that, to make the federal government actually measure and count what it does, because somebody knows, but we don't. So in addition to bringing peace around the world, we've got to bring some sanity to our policy here at home, because in more ways than we imagine, war is unhealthy for children, the ecology, and other living things. So I look forward to seeing all of us asking for accountability and peace, because war destroys the planet. And for whatever value there is in the electoral system, which is sometimes confused with democracy, we have a lot of work to do. And now, the change is in our hands, and I'm glad to be with you today.
This song was written by our friend Guy Davis. Though we changed some of the words, we still love the song.
We all need more kindness in this world. We all need more kindness in this world. You may look high and low, but there's no place else to go. We all need more kindness in this world. Housing! We all need more housing in this world. We all need more housing in this world. You may look high and low, but there's no place else to go. We all need more housing in this world.
We all need more clean water in this world.
Yeah.
Town kids, come see us at the Beacon Swim Club Strawberry Festival and at the Great Hudson River Revival coming up in June.
The Rivertown Kids in an outdoor performance celebrating Earth Day with Volunteers for Peace. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins, Reggie Johnson, and Grayson Challenger, and produced with Thiago Barroso. We welcome your comments to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.